This is an ABC podcast. Good morning and welcome to Pacific Beat. My name is Jordan Fennell. Today on the show, the political turmoil in Papua New Guinea continues as opposition MPs have returned to the capital, Port Moresby, for a parliament sitting, despite the decision for parliament to go ahead still being before the Supreme Court. We'll have an update on the situation from the ABC's PNG correspondent, Natalie Whiting, coming up in about 5 minutes. And the Fiji Silktails Rugby League team are following in the footsteps of the PNG Hunters, with plans to relocate to Australia full-time for the 2021 season to get around international travel restrictions.
Plus side of being over there for the whole 20 rounds or so, you know, they get more exposure and more chance to be seen by the NRL clubs, and that's a definite plus for the playing squad.
More on that story coming up in around 30 minutes. But first, frustrated Solomon Islanders are still living with the waste of a wrecked ship more than 2 years after it ran aground.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Almost 2 years after the bulk carrier, the Solomon Trader made international headlines when it ran aground near a World Heritage Site in the Solomon Islands. Tons of contaminated oil, sand and rubbish from the cleanup operation is sitting abandoned in the capital, Honiara. One frustrated local contractor says they're stuck with the waste, have no way of destroying it and claim to be almost $1 million out of pocket. It comes after a report commissioned by the government was leaked to the ABC last week. It estimates the cost of the environmental damage at Rennell Island could be as high as $50 million. Evan Wasuka has more from Honiara.
Stacks of yellow plastic bags with the word contaminated in black bold lettering on its side are piled in the corner of a Honiara boatyard. Some are broken, others torn, and sand covered with black oil spills out. Others hold floaters, a boom, and bits of plastic. All are covered in oil.
Some of the bags where you look in blue extra, have more oil mixed with
some
sand.
Of these bags, the one with the blue cross, that's oil mixed with sand. Those with the green or yellow marking, they're empty plastic containers touched by oil. These bags have been sitting here for a long time. That's why they're broken. You see these sand? Anyone touched by oil is dug up and sent here.
Any small stone where I'm color oil or the picking.
Gordon Teho works for Douglas Logistics and Salvage, a local company subcontracted to help US company Resolve salvage the Solomon Trader when it ran aground. Mr. Teho spent 5 months in Rennell working on the salvage and subsequent cleanup operation. Remains of that operation can be seen in the boatyard, large 200-gallon containers filled with oil that was collected from the sea and the stricken vessel sit in the sun.
These containers are full of oil we collected, some from the sea and others pumped out from the wreck. This is the oil that came out from the ship, is the same as tar. It's very thick.
When the MV Solomon Trader ran aground, it was picking up bauxite ore at a mine in Rennell. The ship's owner, Hong Kong-based King Trader, and its insurer, Korea Protection and Indemnity Club, hired US salvager Resolve to refloat and remove the vessel. The contaminated waste from Rennell was meant to be sent to Korea for disposal, but it never made it past Honiara. Francis De Oro, finance manager for Douglas Logistics, says shipping arrangements fell through and they were asked by the insurer to store the waste.
We have not been paid since June. It's for us for the storage fee and plus for our workers who have been working to shift the rubbish every now and then to make sure that the rubbish is not has not gone into the sea to cause damage to our seafront and also the environment around surrounding the Ranandi seafront.
She says after a while, the payments for storage stopped and they've had to front the warehouse costs. Ms. Doro says she's disappointed after all the hard work, they've ended up in the red with more than $1 million owed from the salvage job and storage.
I think we have been forgotten by them, that they don't care or they don't mind that we have been sitting on this hazardous rubbish but they have not been getting back to us to let us know of their future plans for this removal of the rubbish here.
Resolve disputes this. In an email to the ABC, the company's general manager said the company had settled all its bills with its contractors, but it was not privy to other arrangements made by the ship's owner or insurer. Insurer, Korea Protection and Indemnity Club did not respond to our questions. Ms. Doro says apart from the financial cost, the contaminated materials are a health hazard to her staff and customers.
The rubbish has been sitting here for about 2 years now, and it has been a concern for us because it's taking up a lot of space, and at the same time, it's quite hazardous, and we have people coming in to do their freighting, and our boats going out every now and then. We have a lot of people coming in, sitting around here, so we're just worried that in regards with their health, our passengers and our workers.
Ms. Doro says requests to the Environment Ministry to allow them to destroy the waste in a trench burn have gone unanswered. In April, when Category 1 Cyclone Harold hit the Solomons, the boatyard was swamped and some of the contaminated rubbish was washed away. Ginny Spillis at Douglas Logistics is worried the same could happen again or even worse.
It was stable here, man. This time it's season board.
Now it's cyclone season again. Very soon it could be washed away. If the sea comes in, it will cause a problem for those around here.
Another problem for you, mother, yeah? Especially the Ronandi side.
Ginnis Spillis of Douglas Logistics and Salvage in Honiara speaking there to reporter Evan Wasuka. And Pacific Beat has sent questions to the Solomon Islands Director of Environment, but he has yet to respond.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
That's right. My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat. There are still big questions over what will unfold this week in Papua New Guinean politics. Opposition MPs have arrived back in the capital, Port Moresby, and are pledging to head to Parliament tomorrow, even though the question of whether it should sit then is still before the Supreme Court. The matter returns to court today, while on Friday, a 6-judge bench in the Supreme Court dismissed a separate case by the opposition leader, Beldon Nama, who claimed the election of Prime Minister James Marape last year was invalid. Speaking to the media yesterday, Mr. Nama said this separate court case does not change what happened on the floor of Parliament earlier this month.
When we made an unprecedented move on the 13th of November this month, we didn't move because of this court decision. And let me make that very clear. The move we made on the 13th of November was basically to prevent James Marape from returning the Parliament into the grace period of the National General Election.
And former Attorney General Davis Stephen, who deflected to the opposition camp, echoed that sentiment.
This decision of the Supreme Court does not say that he is immune from a motion of no confidence. This decision in no way affects all the other rights and lawful obligations of the Speaker and of members of Parliament.
And if that wasn't already enough to deal with, several MPs have also tested for COVID-19. Joining us now from Port Moresby is PNG correspondent Natalie Whiting. Good morning, Natalie.
Good morning.
Natalie, first, last Friday, as we just heard, there was that court case against Prime Minister James Marape that was settled and we heard from opposition members. However, what has the reaction been to the ruling from the public and from the government?
Well, as you said, we did get a unanimous ruling from the 5-man bench, which basically said that the matter wasn't within the court's purview to be dealing with. They said there wasn't a specific breach of the Constitution for them to rule on in terms of the nomination and election of Mr. Marape to Prime Minister. So they said it wasn't in their purview, but a few of them did also comment that they thought procedures had been properly followed. So that was the first big hurdle for Mr. Marape, and he obviously welcomed that. Both sides, actually, government and opposition, have come out strongly saying this represents, the court ruling on a separation of powers, that Parliament that they shouldn't have been, that the court wasn't going to interfere in Parliament because there wasn't that specific constitutional issue. So that's been welcomed on all sides. In terms of the public response, obviously we are seeing people support both sides of this. So there's been a lot of people saying, you know, that this is how it's meant to be, that the Prime Minister, Mr. Marape, is the rightful Prime Minister, and, you know, this is just showing it. But then on the flip side, there are those who are supporting the opposition who are saying, you know, that's only one part of things. And as you mentioned, there's still a lot more to play out.
Now, Natalie, turning to this week's events, the opposition MPs appear set to head to Parliament tomorrow, but it's been adjourned until April next year. And that is part of the case that's back before the Supreme Court today. Do you expect the matter will be settled today?
Well, I'm loath to predict anything in PNG politics, as most people who are followers of PNG would back me in on. It's always dangerous to predict things. However, based on the previous two sittings of the Supreme Court on this matter, which I've been in court for, I don't think we will get to the point of a decision today. There's still a few court formalities to go through today. We're expecting them to be, you know, judging on what's called interveners, which is basically other parties like the Speaker or Prime Minister saying, I want to be involved in this court case. So we're still at sort of some early stages in terms of the court processes. That said, the Chief Justice has been commenting that he's concerned about this December 1 sort of deadline for the court. So he is very much aware that there are real world impacts about this. He's spoken about being concerned about impacts on the public, on the innocent people, he said. So certainly the Chief Justice is aware of the real world impacts. So we could see perhaps either side push for court orders specifically about tomorrow. But as to whether we get a final ruling, I think that could be difficult.
If that is difficult and the ruling doesn't come down in time, but as you say, the Chief Justice has concerns about tomorrow, December 1st, will the opposition even be let in the doors of Parliament?
Look, it's quite unclear at this point. As you say, we did see the government obviously come back and then adjourn it again until April, and that is what the parliamentary staff are working on. That's, you know, that they're obviously following that process. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens tomorrow. As you said, the opposition on Friday did say that they, you know, were coming back to Port Moresby, and we have seen them come back. They say that Parliament should be sitting. So as to whether we see anything at Parliament House, I think remains to be seen. I think everyone's taking things one step at a time, and we'll see what happens in court this morning as to whether we see anyone actually turn up to Parliament tomorrow.
Now, it does sound unlikely to go ahead. If it did go ahead, though, we've heard of these COVID-19 cases that have come out of the opposition MP's camp. What impact will that have on the situation, or do we have any update on the COVID-19 situation there?
So the COVID-19 patients are actually in the government camp. So we've had three MPs test positive out of the government camp. We haven't had an update on any other MPs testing positive at the moment. It's remaining at that three. However, we have been told that more testing was being done during the week. We've had various government MPs still out and about. And some of them had said they hadn't been tested or were waiting on results. But at the moment, it's still sitting at that three. So that's obviously going to be a factor. And then obviously, Jordan, we've just got the movement of people again. You know, the government's now coming out saying that people are, you know, MPs are going to be moving back to its side, that it's confident of maintaining a majority because it says it's in contact with MPs coming back. But we're also hearing the opposition say that they're feeling safe in their numbers. So there's many variables at play here. And as we always see in these situations, both sides claiming that they have the MPs and they have a plan.
There's so many moving parts to this. Nat, you're in Port Moresby at the moment. Is there a sense of anxiety at all amongst people on the streets about what may be about to unfold?
I wouldn't say anxiety. I actually think people have been remaining quite calm and you know, taking it in their stride, really. Everyone is following it. You know, people in Port Moresby and PNG are tuned in and, are interested in how this is going to play out and are interested in the latest news. But we haven't seen any kind of unrest, even in the court sitting on Friday, which was obviously very significant. There weren't big crowds that gathered. Obviously, we have had extra police brought in to Port Moresby in case there was some kind of unrest, but we haven't seen any signs of that at this stage. So, the police commissioners come out and commended people on that. And as I say, everything I've seen is people quite calm and taking in their stride. If anything, there's possibly a little bit of frustration. You've got to remember, for people, it's only 18 months since we last saw this sort of process. So I think for some people, there's a little bit of frustration at seeing politics stalled again like this. But a lot of people are just sort of saying, you know, let it play out and let's see what happens.
Finally, we know that Australia's Prime Minister cancelled his planned visit to Port Moresby as this political turmoil unfolded earlier in the month. Do you think that the Australian government will be on edge watching developments this week?
I don't know that they'll be on edge now that they've cancelled their trip. I think they would have been very much on edge when all of this first started and when we saw that mass walkout on Mr. Marape, because they did have that upcoming visit planned. But I think at this point it's definitely being closely watched. There's obviously interest from Australia as to who's leading their nearest nation, and especially given all the various agreements and aid and everything that happens between the two countries, they're certainly watching closely. But I think at this time, they, like everyone else, are just waiting to see where the dust settles and if it does settle now or if we could see this continuing on into the new year.
Natalie, thanks so much for bringing us those updates.
Thank you.
PNG correspondent Natalie Whiting bringing us those updates on all the PNG political turmoil happening this week.
Radio Australia now has a WhatsApp. Just add +61437519385 to your phone. It means you can message Radio Australia from anywhere in the Pacific. So add +61437519385 and send us a message. Tell us what you want to hear and join the conversations on Radio Australia.
Let's have some music on this Monday morning. This is one of Harry Styles' newer ones from his new album. This is Golden. Styles there with his song Golden. Now time to find out all the latest weather news from across the region, and I'm joined by Neville Coop, the director of Nandraki Weather. Good morning, Neville.
Yeah, hi, good morning.
Neville, how's it looking out there today on this Monday?
Yeah, look, last day of spring, we start summer tomorrow, of course. So here in the Pacific, it's been decent sort of a weekend after some rain cleared away on Saturday. From central parts of the region, but high pressure now dominates. It's sitting east of New Caledonia and south of Vanuatu, and that high pressure is keeping trade winds pretty much right across Melanesia and into Polynesia around Tonga as well. Weak frontal system is crossing New Lane and bends back up across Wallace and Petun and the central parts of the Tongan group. But no rain in that, just a bit of haze in the sky, some very high clouds moving across that part of the world. So, and that looks like it's going to stay pretty much the way of the world for the next few days at least. High pressure is going to stay almost stationary across waters south of Fiji. That'll keep the trade winds light to moderate. No sign of anything significant on the horizon at this stage.
And I hear, though, that if people head outside tonight and look up into the stars, they might see a great full moon.
Yes, it's full moon tonight, and for the Pacific, especially here in Fiji, where skies will be clear, most other countries in the region should have good clear skies as well. So take a look out, of course, just on dusk, and you'll see the moon rise to the east. Nice big full moon tonight. This is actually just a bit of trivia. Last month, you might remember, we had blue moon, but for the Pacific, this is our blue moon, because the last full moon of October actually occurred in the very early hours of November in our part of the world. So this is our second full moon for the month of November. So a blue moon here in the Pacific that they enjoyed in other parts of the world back in October. So you don't often get two full moons in a 30-day month. So quite a feat and something to take us into summer.
Yeah, definitely. And if you missed that first full moon, then you've got a second chance tonight, which is wonderful. Neville Coop, thank you so much for bringing us those updates.
You're welcome.
That was Neville Coop, the director of Nandraki Weather out of Fiji. And if you want to find out any of the latest weather news from today, from across the region, across the week, you can just head to Facebook and type in Nandraki Weather. Now it's time to find out all the latest news updates from around the region, and I'm joined by Talia Olatia. Good morning, Talia.
Hola.
Talia.
Spanish there. I don't even know what that was about.
That was just a loose Monday morning greeting, and I'm here for it.
It's something that I always just say to my parents. I'm like, yeah, hola. And then I think I was just with them over the weekend, and I was just like, yeah, that's how you greet people.
Hola. Yeah.
Just keeping people on their toes.
Let's start with a key meeting between the governments of PNG and Vaughanville that has been delayed.
Yeah, that's right. Radio New Zealand is reporting that the joint supervisory body between the Papua New Guinean government with PM James Marape and the autonomous Vaughanville government with President Ismail Tarama was due to meet this Friday in Port Moresby. But in a statement, the Vaughanville government has pushed the meeting back by 2 weeks without giving an explanation. The big issue on the table at this meeting is, of course, the negotiation of Bougainville's move towards independence after their historic referendum win last year. And of course, as we just heard from PNG correspondent Nat Whiting, the delay does come amid an ongoing political standoff in PNG, with the opposition waiting to bring a vote of no confidence against Prime Minister James Marape. So maybe there is a chance that it is connected to that, and they're just seeing, you know, what's going to happen in the next 2 weeks before this meeting comes back together. Now, both governments, however, have agreed on 16 recommendations to go before the joint supervisory body when it does eventually meet. And some of these recommendations are really interesting. They include the possibility of establishing a permanent secretariat to support the joint government consultation process, endorsing the appointment of former Irish Prime Minister Bertie Ahern as the international moderator for these ongoing consultations, the transfer of shares in the miner BCL that have been divested to Port Moresby by Rio Tinto, in which the previous PNG government had promised to Bougainville. Bougainville are also wanting greater control over its fisheries and taxation, and also funding for small and medium enterprises, which Mr. Tarama signalled as the key to developing the regional economy. So there's a lot of it on the agenda when the joint supervisory body does meet. It just won't be this Friday, as previously thought.
Yeah, so I guess everyone in Bougainville watching with anticipation to see what comes out of this political turmoil in PNG this week.
Exactly.
Now, Talia, to Vanuatu, where there's been a development in plans to scrap the Ministry of Justice and Community Services.
Yeah, that's right. You'll remember this story from a few weeks ago. Richard Hewitt brought it to us, of how Vanuatu's government is planning to break up the country's Ministry of Justice and Community Services, which had been heavily criticised by the country's opposition, and also as well by female advocates who warned that such a move could see important issues like domestic violence fall through the cracks as a result. And on Friday, the latest development is that in her personal capacity and in the public's interest, the Director General of the Ministry of Justice, Doris Day Kenneth Watson, took legal action in attempts to intervene with those plans. In the minutes and orders from the judicial review, Judge V.M. Treif said the question of whether there was a breach of the Government Act is a serious question to be tried regarding a lack of natural justice, as Ms. Watson and other interested parties were not consulted by the government about these plans. Judge Treif also said that the applicant would be seriously disadvantaged if the order is not granted, and that if the evidence by the claimant remains as it is, then the claimant is likely to succeed. So the judge ordered that the Council of Ministers' decision regarding the restructure of the Ministry of Justice and Community Services into a Ministry of Fisheries, Ocean and Maritime Affairs is stayed pending final determination of the claim for judicial review in the proceedings. And the matter is now listed for next year at 8:30 a.m. on February the 26th.
It's very specific timing there.
I was actually going, no one cares that it's at 8:30, but I was like, someone might care. I just feel like 8:30 a.m. means it's going to be the first point of order on February 26th to deal with what's going on.
Well, it seems like a really big move to restructure the Ministry of Justice and Community Services into a Ministry of Fisheries,
exactly,
Ocean and Maritime Affairs.
Yes, exactly, which is why this new legal action brought by the director herself of the Ministry of Justice and Community Services is an interesting one, and it kind of just delays those plans a little bit longer because now it's before the courts.
We'll definitely keep our eye on that here at Pacific Beat. Now, Talia, finally, a PNG cricket player is up for nomination in the International Cricket Council's Awards of the Decade.
That's right. The International Cricket Council, or ICC for short, are recognising the best players across cricket over the past 10 years. And for the first time, fans will actually get to have a say into who the winner will be. Well, they'll get a 10% of the vote. The other 90% will come from an expert panel, but you still can have a say.
10% a say.
Majority, minority, it's fine. But the reason why I mentioned that is because, as you said, PNG can get behind Asad Vala, the left-handed batsman and off-spin bowler and current captain of the national team, the Barramundis. He's played national cricket for PNG since 2005, and he's been nominated in the ICC's Men's Associate Cricketer of the Decade category, which seeks to recognise the best overall performer in men's associate cricket during the performance period. The performance period is the 1st of January 2011 to the 7th of October 2020. So it's obviously a decade, and you can still have a bad game in that and still be nominated and do well, which is very good news for all those cricketers who are nominated. In reaction to Cricket PNG posting the news on Facebook, Brian has said it's a truly deserved recognition of what Asad Vala has achieved for so long, and Nobert says that he is PNG true and true. So I'm sure if PNG can gather around that they can, put a lot of votes in and maybe, get that 10% fan vote.
Could sway something.
And then it'd be up to the expert panel. Just for mention, the other nominees in the category are Richie Berrington from Scotland, Peter Boren from the Netherlands, Kyle Kutzer from Scotland again, Paras Khadka from Nepal, and again, another Scottish nominee in Callum McLeod. For more information on how to vote for Asad Vala, assuming that that is where your vote will go, you can check out the ICC website.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed for Asad Vala, exactly. And everyone in PNG rooting behind him.
What a, a recognition to be like, you are the cricketer of the decade.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Not even just the year or the match. It's just like for the past 10 years, you've been it.
Good job. Talia, thank you so much for bringing us those updates.
Thanks, Jordan.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now let's have a bit more music. This is Ballpark Music with their song All I Want Is You.
I'm absolutely aching to lie down next to my girl and tell her all about it. I had to stop at every single red light. I couldn't get a word in when I finally saw the bar. And all I wanted is you.
Ballpark Music there with their song All I Want Is You.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat. Samoa has recorded its second coronavirus case in a 70-year-old man who travelled from Auckland, New Zealand. The country lost its COVID-free status earlier this month after a sailor on the same repatriation flight tested positive. However, what followed was confusion over the man's COVID status when Prime Minister Tuilapa Seleili Mali'ilangaoli revealed that the sailor tested positive in his left nostril and negative in his right nostril. Both cases are in quarantine and the country has continued to enforce restrictions. And having been devastated by disease in the past with last year's measles epidemic and the infamous 1918 influenza outbreak, the country remains on high alert. To talk about the impact of these past brushes with deadly diseases and the impact they've had on Samoa, I'm joined now by Toto Olea va Dr. Fanafi Iono Letunga Loloa, a law lecturer and convener of Pacific Engagement at the University of Waikato. Talofalava.
Good morning.
Good morning. Dr. Fanafi, Samoa was one of the only countries in the world to keep coronavirus at bay until this month. What was the reactions of people there when it was first revealed that COVID-19 was in the country?
I think the first reaction, understandably, was a lot of panic, especially because even though we'd been waiting for this to happen, when it finally did occur, yeah, it was, I think the best word to describe it would have been panic and worry and a lot of fear, yeah.
Before coronavirus got to Samoa, the most recent disease outbreak that Samoa had dealt with was the measles crisis of 2019, where 83 children died after it ripped through the community. What effect has the memory of that had on the country as it's watched COVID-19 spread around the world?
I think it's had a good effect and a bad effect. The good effect was that we took the coronavirus much more seriously because we had just come out of the situation with the measles, and that would probably be the good side of it. And then again, trying to make sure that everybody is more vigilant. That's another good side. But the negative side is, again, like I said, the fears, especially because measles has a vaccine, and yet we lost so many people to it in this modern day and era, whereas with coronavirus, as you know, there isn't a vaccine, so the fears were increased.
One of the other big impacts of disease that has had an impact on Samoa is the 1918 Spanish influenza, which coronavirus, when that first began to spread around the world, it was compared to the 1918 Spanish influenza. That estimated to have eventually killed up to 50 million people worldwide. What impact did the 1918 flu have on Samoa?
One of the main ones would have been the loss of the older generation. Like, for example, in my family, we lost two generations, a great-grandfather and a great-great-grandfather. And so the leadership and the leadership succession is one of the main issues around that. And I guess, again, with coronavirus and how it really impacts the elderly more, in what if you observe in the overseas countries where it is affected, especially, for example, Italy. So there again is those sorts of associations and those fears because being a communal culture and a Pacific culture, the leadership, or as in most cultures really, remains with the elderly. And when you have that gap, then that loss and passing on from one generation to another of not only the lore, L-O-R-E, but also the lore of a particular land, it does raise major concerns about stability, especially politically.
On that topic, Samoa is leading up to its next general election. How will the handling of this pandemic, do you think, impact that upcoming election with that talk of stability and instability?
I think it's going to play a major part. People are going to be of two minds about whether it is or not. Like there were some people saying that it's not an election issue. But in the minds of other people, it will be an election issue, especially because we're fresh on the tails of measles last year, and it's the same administration as we're heading into coronavirus. And this particular administration has been in power for, so the current prime minister has been in power for more than 2 decades, and it's a very long time for any democracy. I think it might be a record for any Westminster democracy. So people should be looking at it and would be looking at it. And we've had some other elections that have had some major impacts due to coronavirus, like, for example, here in New Zealand and also in the United States of America. So I think it's something to watch out for, and I think people will be considering it heading into next year's elections.
And now New Zealand has played a role in both the 1918 Spanish influenza pandemic and the measles epidemic that hit Samoa last year. Could you just explain a little bit about what role New Zealand played in both those pandemics, and I guess even potentially in this recent COVID-19 era?
So with the 1918 one, it was New Zealand, Samoa just come under New Zealand administration in 1914 with the outbreak of World War One, and then New Zealand troops occupied Samoa on behalf of, I guess, the greater British Empire at that time. And then the ship wasn't quarantined, and the people just came on board with the disease. So that's 1918. And then with the measles epidemic, well, a lot of blame was sort of shoveled around because the measles epidemic actually began in New Zealand. And so, again, there are those links of people traveling to Samoa from New Zealand. And there wasn't that quarantined issue. But I think vaccination is not a mitigating factor, but I guess mitigating on behalf, if you're looking at the blame that was placed on New Zealand, on Samoa's part, that's their responsibility, is the vaccination of their little people. And then coronavirus, because the repatriation flight came from New Zealand. But the two positive cases, the first gentleman flew to Samoa transiting in New Zealand, but from the United States, and he was a sailor in Italy. So that's another, so it's not quite New Zealand in that case. In the second case, the person originated in Melbourne, transited in New Zealand, and then went to Samoa on that repatriation flight on the 13th of November. So two more direct, but this 2019 less direct, and then 2020 even less direct relationship with New Zealand.
Yeah, it seems that there's much more of a global link or chain there with the COVID-19. And you brought up how in the 1918 influenza pandemic there wasn't that quarantine. However, in 2020, these two cases in Samoa have been quarantined. And Samoa is still in a state of emergency with restrictions in place despite no cases in the community. As we said, they're in quarantine at the moment. You're a lawyer and a law lecturer. Do you believe the legal argument for that still stands, for that state of emergency, or do you think it's giving the government too much control?
I think you sort of have to look at the different countries specifically. You sort of can't really apply the situation in New Zealand, for example, and the quarantines here and those in Australia to the situation in Samoa. Again, it would probably emphasize more and more the history of the nation, add to that the particular economic situation, and probably more so the economic and infrastructural and health sector type of considerations for safety. When you're looking at issues of life and death, I think there is a possibility and there is a sort of tendency to fear more about civil liberties and protections of that kind. But I think more primarily at the forefront of people is staying alive, especially as they watch the numbers grow at really horrifying rates in other parts of the world.
Yeah,
that's a very nice, vaguely legal sort of response.
Yes. Well, we're hoping, of course, that no more cases do get to Samoa, and if they do, that they do stay in quarantine and don't get out to the community. So, Dr. Fanafi Ayonule Tangaloa, thank you so much for joining us on the show this morning.
Thank you for your call, Jordan. Have a good day.
You as well. That was Dr. Fanafi Ayonule Tangaloa. She's a law lecturer and convener of Pacific Engagement at the University of Waikato in New Zealand, and she was speaking to me there.
Island Music brings you the finest reggae from Jamaica and around the world with a spotlight on the freshest Pacifica talent.
Join me, Rick Howe, for Island Music, a two-hour journey from the foundation of Jamaican popular music from ska, rocksteady, roots, dub and dancehall, plus the freshest new releases and a spotlight on emerging talent from around the Pacific.
Every Saturday with Rick Howe from 12 till 2 p.m. PNG time on Radio Australia, across the Pacific.
Now let's have a little bit more music. This is Alpine with Lovers. Alpine with their song Lovers.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
The Fiji Silktails rugby league team are following in the footsteps of the PNG Hunters with plans to relocate to Australia full-time for the 2021 season to get around international travel restrictions. And in another big development, the new club are about to sign off on a partnership deal with the Sydney Roosters NRL team. As Richard Hewitt reports, for those players with families, being away from Fiji for more than 6 months will be tough, but there's excitement about the chance to put themselves in the NRL shop window for an entire season.
The Silktails' debut in New South Wales Ron Massey Cup competition was successful but brief. One game and one big win, 40-16 on home territory over the Windsor Wolves in La Toca. Then COVID-19 struck and the rest of the season was abandoned. Now, borders may be opening up in Australia, but the lifting of international travel barriers and quarantine restrictions is some way off yet. So the decision has been taken by the Silktails management to set up camp in Sydney next year to guarantee they can take a full part in the 2021 season. But coach Wes Nagama concedes it's a move that could certainly pose personal problems for some of his players.
We had a meeting and had a chat about what the difficulties could be, and we kept an open mind and open door policy where if they sort of that was going to be a struggle, that we had that conversation, and also if they needed support along the way, you know, we could always be there for them.
But while there might be difficulties, Nagama says the move to Australia also opens up big possibilities.
The plus side of being over there for the whole 20 rounds or so, you know, they get more exposure and more chance to be seen by the NRL clubs, and that's a definite plus for the playing squad.
Steve Driscoll is the Silktails' chief executive, and he says while the switch to Sydney is not ideal, it's the sensible option.
Oh, look, the perfect scenario would be they get the chance to play half the season in front of their friends and family and loved ones, as well as doing it here. But we've done some really good stuff in country this year in terms of building the game from the ground up and rebuilding our footy program. So, yeah, don't get to see the benefits of that if we're not playing in this competition. So it's important that we just make that part happen.
Once the 2020 season was called off, money set aside to fund the Silktails' first year in the New South Wales competition setup was reallocated to the EDP. The Elite Development Program in Fiji. And Steve Driscoll says it's a move that's had a huge impact during the domestic season, which wasn't affected by COVID-19.
We've set up three training centres, one in La Toca, which is our centre of excellence, and then we've put one in the Coral Coast at Singatoka Methodist College, and then we've set one up underneath the FNRL's headquarters in Suva. The best part about what we've been able to do this year is that we've got 90 guys training in these different pods, and it's been a bit of a roadmap put out to them all in terms of when we feel that they'll be ready to become Silktails. So a lot of those guys are long-term projects and they're fully aware of that, and it's all been part of the education around those guys wanting to become Silktails players.
We were able to identify the 90 best players across Fiji. Through that, we were able to start our Pathways program, just to see the growth of these boys from day one to the end of the season to the grand final now has been amazing. You know, physically getting them in the gym for 3 days a week. For the first 8 weeks of the competition, we had them on the field for 2 sessions as well. And then they went back to their clubs and trained with them and played with them. And the way they applied themselves has been great, you know, and it's raised the standard of the competition over here big time. There's a heap of them involved in the grand final and the third state of origin. I think across the both teams in the state of origin, there's 26 players involved from our EDP. And I'm just really excited. I get to name the first 15 contracted blokes after the grand final, and then we'll keep running the EDP through to December. I'll name the last 12 spots, and then we'll come together for our pre-season as a group for the first time in January.
There was also money put aside to fund club registrations in Fiji, and Steve Driscoll says the spin-off effect on the local competition has been dramatic.
The Vodafone Cup had 27 teams participate this year, which is the highest it's ever been. And the beauty of what our program's done is it really, it's really evened out the competition because there's been a lot more players exposed to better training and our EDP program. And reviving that Coral Coast and Singatoko region's been a real target of the Silktails, and it's really paid dividends there.
Once they arrive in Sydney next year, the Silktails profile is set to rise significantly, with approval imminent for a partnership deal with one of the NRL's biggest names, the Sydney Roosters. And as a result, Wes Nagama says there is plenty of excitement in the Silktails camp.
Some of them are Sydney Roosters supporters, you know, just for the chance for them to progress and play for the Roosters one day will be a great opportunity. But I just feel with that relationship, we'll all become better managers, better coaches and better players. I know there's an opportunity there too for our women's rugby league team to transition into playing at a high level with the Roosters. All in all, if it was to go forward, it'd just be a great thing for not only the Silktails, but for rugby league in Fiji.
Right now, a significant slice of the funding for the Silktails is coming from the Australian government. Steve Driscoll says that deal is locked in until 2023, but the team is ambitious to become self-sufficient as soon as possible.
We're not just going to rest on our laurels and hope that they continue to support us. We need to be a little bit smart about what we do and use this to get on the back of some good corporate support and take advantage commercially of what we can do here. We're building a really big online following at the moment. Both the rugby league community and our Fijian community, the interest is through the roof. So once we actually make the official announcement, when we get here, stuff like our membership and all that can start to take shape. And hopefully in this next 4-year period, you know, really secure our place long term.
And while the Fijian team is based at their home away from home in Sydney during 2021, moves are afoot to ensure that their fans back in the islands don't miss out on following the action.
We have spoken with the New South Wales Rugby League and the NRL about that. They think that it won't be an issue, so that it'll just be purely around how that platform works. It's top of the discussions that we're having with them at the moment. Unfortunately, we don't have an answer on that yet, but the indications are really positive that we can do that.
TV coverage is certainly a key part of not just maintaining the momentum in Fiji, but building on it. Because while rugby and rugby sevens have dominated the sporting landscape there for the longest time, Wes Nagama says the tide is starting to turn in rugby league's favour.
We're definitely narrowing the gap. Kids out of high school, all they knew was sevens and playing rugby union for Fiji. But just with the standard of the competition, word getting around, every Wednesday since I got out of isolation in July has been dedicated to community work. So we've been able to go into places where rugby league hasn't been before. Rucky Rucky, the Yasawas, the rugby league had never been taken there. We're just trying to spread the word and show our presence here and just let these boys and girls know that if you want to play rugby league at a high level, there's a direct pathway for you to do that now.
Wes Nagama, coach of the Fiji Silktails rugby league team, who will be setting up camp in Sydney in 2021. And the reporter there was Richard Hewitt.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
That's all for the program this morning, but Richard Hewitt will be along at 3 p.m. PNG time for the afternoon edition of Pacific Beat. Stay with us though on Radio Australia across the day and head over to the ABC Radio Australia Facebook page so you can stay up to date with all the latest news and developments. We'll keep you up to date with any breaking news over there. On the Facebook page is also where you can join in the conversation and have your say on all the stories from today, from the political turmoil in PNG to the impact COVID-19 and past deadly diseases have had and are having on Samoa. Get in touch and let me know what you think. We're also on Twitter if you want to find us there. My name's Jordan Fennell. Thanks so much for joining me this morning. Have a wonderful Monday and I'll catch you tomorrow.